Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Early Modern History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Yana Byers, your host, and I'm here today with Angela Van Halen, professor of art history and communications at McGill University in Montreal, to talk about her new book, The Moving Statues of 17th Century Amsterdam, Automata, Waxworks, Fountains, Labyrinths, out 2022 with Penn State University Press. Hello, Angela, and how are you today?
Hi, I'm good.
A nice winter afternoon in our morning in Montreal.
Yes, it is.
Wonderful. So thank you so much for taking time to talk to me today. I really enjoyed the book. It was completely educational. I had no idea these things even existed. And now I'm so excited. And as it turns out, I've seen a few. So that's really cool. I'm really excited to get into it.
Good.
Okay, so your book opens with the line, "The Moving Statues of 17th Century Amsterdam is a study of idiosyncratic attractions called doolhoven, or labyrinths, which were unique to early modern Amsterdam." And I rarely have to ask this sort of question, but I think it's appropriate here. So what are these? What are doolhoven?
Yeah, so they seem to be something that a group of people in Amsterdam sort of made up. So they started to use inns or taverns, so public spaces, public houses, to display really different kind of innovative artworks. And partly I think it was because the Calvinist church was fairly repressive in this time period, especially about images and especially about images that seemed almost lifelike, like an automata is a moving statue or waxworks look like they're actual people, right? So to kind of avoid some of the repressive tactics of the church, you could use your own business to display these kinds of artworks. And so I think it was that kind of strategy that prompted this, and maybe that's why this happened only in Amsterdam in these particular, especially in the early decades of the 17th century. So but doolhof literally means like a labyrinth. So they actually did have hedge labyrinths within them. So they're almost like little amusement parks that people began to construct in their inns and in the courtyards of their inns.
So I walk into a place, I get a drink,
yep,
hang out, go through this labyrinth. And this is all still in Amsterdam, a city with not a lot of space.
That's right. Yeah, that's true. So yeah, they seem to, like, sometimes the inns had adjoining courtyards. And then what I found is if they were successful, they might be able to buy like a neighboring property and expand those mm-hmm. gardens. So there was one that had like two labyrinths, like a round one and a square one. So I think it was a kind of early instance of amusement parks. And there were these kind of labyrinths in like elite pleasure palaces and villas, so of the upper classes. So it was a kind of well-known form of pleasure and entertainment for the elite, but to make it into a kind of popular attraction, that was like a really new idea. So they used what little space they had, I guess, to develop this.
That's so interesting. Yeah, I've been to contemporary mazes in North Italy, right? And but the idea, but in the city, it's so small.
That's right. There are a lot of Italian ones where, and some of them still exist, like in Northern Italy, where you can still kind of walk through these, these. And there were quite a few in France and Flanders as well. Yeah.
So how did you come to write this book? How did you learn about this? And what struck you? When did you decide you needed to write a book about this?
Ah, it's like a long process because it was hard to figure them out. Like there wasn't a lot published about them. Almost none of the actual artworks survive. So none of the, there were a lot of wax statues and none of those survive. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of automata, different types of moving mechanical statues. And there's like two that are now in the Amsterdam Museum, the historical museum in the middle of Amsterdam, of David and Goliath. So I did see those when I was a kid. Like one of my aunts took us to the museum, to the cafe, because these statues used to just be in the cafe. Oh. So they weren't displayed really as historical artifacts, but more as kind of quirky holdovers, something like for kids to enjoy. So they weren't taken all that seriously. So I guess I first saw it when I was a kid and I was quite struck by them, but they weren't moving at that time. They've since been restored and they actually move now. And then I think when I was doing my thesis research as a PhD student, I came across some, because I was working on popular culture, I came across some mentions of these, mm-hmm. Of these inns and the displays and their little guidebooks that have some pictures. And so I saw that, but for me as a student, it was just like way too much to try to take that on. And so I returned to it later after I'd worked on several other kind of projects. It was always there in the back of my head as a kind of puzzle to figure out. So, so I came back to it, you know, at a later point.
I can see how they struck with you because it's cool. So there is very little that's been done about them, but in general, how have they been treated in scholarship and really in memory? Like what's kind of the prevailing opinion of these things?
Yeah, I guess what happened is in scholarship, it was really archivists, like people working in the Amsterdam archives who could see that there was actually quite a lot of publicity material. There were little pamphlets that were published. There were some posters. Also travelers to Amsterdam, like quite, you know, well-known writers like mm-hmm. John Evelyn wrote about going to these sites. And there are quite a few people who wrote about going to these sites. So they were part of like a kind of tourist itinerary. If you were a well-educated upper-class man visiting Amsterdam, you would go to see these things. So there was a lot of publicity, but the archivists, because these sites, they lasted, they start in the 17th century, but they actually last until sort of late into the 19th century. So they're still kind of in memory thought of as being mostly for kids. Because what was innovative in the 17th century was not innovative in the 19th, early 20th century. So it sort of shows us, I guess, a bit how technology changes and interests change and innovation falls into like obsolescence, like, you know, your old cell phone or whatever, or the fax machine. Or so these things, they were sort of then at that point denigrated as being not very sophisticated, mostly for kids and mothers and women. So women and children was kind of, and that's like the worst thing you could say about any cultural form because it means it's kind of frivolous and not a serious intellectual concern. And so there was this kind of like false narrative about these sites then as being really for women, children, lower class people, like, and so a kind of form of mass culture, amusement for, you know, I guess for the masses is kind of how they were looking at it in that time period in the like late 19th, early 20th century when people started to write about it. And so then that kind of, you know, denigration of the sites, that's what kind of prevailed in the scholarship. And then because the objects themselves didn't survive, no one really took them up and did a kind of serious look at a scholarly study or an art historical study of the things and of the sites themselves. So yeah, mm-hmm. So it was kind of forgotten or forgotten for quite a while. And also we focus so much on Dutch paintings because that's what's in the museums. Mm-hmm. And sure. That sort of has defined, you know, the so-called golden age of Dutch culture is, right. But it seems to me that might be wrong, that in the 17th century there were other things that were considered more innovative. So
well, this is the thing you point out, you know, that they're largely forgotten, and when people do think about them, they're ignored or denigrated. But in fact, you argue that there's sites for the display of some of the most cutting-edge technology and considerable artistic prowess.
Yeah. So what it turns out that really some of the best known artists, Hendrik de Keyser was one of the foremost sculptors in 17th century Amsterdam. So his work is there. And there are various other artists who were quite well known in the 17th century whose art was displayed. So it wasn't like, and these are really difficult things to make a kind of lifelike moving mechanical statue. You know, they were supposed to look almost kind of miraculous or magical to the audience, to really kind of impress on them the kind of powers of these marvelous types of things that are made by human beings, but look like they're actually alive. So they really were very sophisticated. And I discovered, I guess the thing that surprised me, because I started out doing a study of popular culture and it ended up being very much about, you know, philosophy and intellectual culture in the end, because these really were considered philosophical objects, things that you think with. Aristotle writes about automata. Descartes is very interested in automata, and so it's part of a longer philosophical tradition. So very interesting to well-educated elite upper class people, not really just for peasants.
Yeah, I mean, they seem to be really multifaceted attractions. You know, they're not just, it's not just entertainment. It's not just a ploy to get more money, right? They're didactic.
Yeah. So they're like, nobody makes cultural objects in the 17th century just for fun. Like that just didn't exist in this time period. Like everything is about somehow educating a public, shaping a public, transforming people. The goal of the city of Amsterdam was always to have a peaceful, harmonious civic society. And they really needed that because they'd just come through the Reformation, a lot of religious divisiveness. They'd come through the Dutch Revolt, so there are a lot of political factions. So they're always a little bit just on the brink of civil war in the 17th century. And so civic harmony, finding ways, cultural means to bring people together was really important. And so I think that's part of the aim of these sites, because the people who owned the inns did tend to be from the ruling classes in Amsterdam, like the families that were also sitting in the city government and on the boards of all of the different cultural institutions. So it's very deliberate, I think, what they're doing. They're really kind of planning this, trying to reach a broad public, to educate people, a little bit like a kind of public academy or something like that, I think is what they had in mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Your introduction concludes with a delightfully unexpected sentence. Just wonderful. Surely among the most contradictory cultural experiments of early modernity, these were beer gardens for the cultivation of the Protestant self. That's great, but we need to unpack that.
Yeah. I guess I started out thinking they were more ecumenical, that they were open to everybody and not necessarily religious. But then as I went along, I began to see that there really were some very key religious ideas that were being conveyed to people. And there were different inns. So especially there's this inn called the New Dolhof, and it was taken over by two Lutheran men who are coming from Germany. And so there you begin to see like the type of displays they had were very religious. There's a lot about like Daniel in the Old Testament. And this took me years to figure out what this meant, but it really did seem to be about bringing the world to perfection. And they're seem very interested in Francis Bacon, for instance, who is a philosopher working in England and sort of a new type of scientific approach. So the hope that the Protestants had was that they could re-educate the entire population, convert them to Protestantism, and then they would also globally convert everybody in the world to Protestantism, because that is the aim of the Reformation. For them, the Reformation isn't over until the whole world has been reformed. Mm-hmm. And once that happens, then the end times will come and Jesus will come back and there'll be the apocalypse.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So they had this strange apocalyptic kind of thing with these prophecies of Daniel in the Old Testament and bringing the kind of earth to fulfillment, which really took me by surprise. But so it did seem like it did have a very specific kind of Protestant goal that people really did believe in. In Amsterdam, there are studies also of Rembrandt that show just how common this way of thinking was. The scholars in the universities thought this, that if they could convert everybody, they would complete the Reformation, and then the world would come to a happy conclusion. And so, so that was a sort of strange aspect of these sites that I didn't really see that one coming, but
there
for sure. Yeah.
No, I can see how that would have been a surprise. So there's this idea that there are items that can affect change, right? There are things that can alter the way the world works, and those can be inanimate objects.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's an interesting thing too, is I guess the power of these objects, because they're so striking, so that when you're in the audience and suddenly a statue starts to move, they were staged in a way that really was supposed to shock people, to kind of, as the statue moves, you're trying to move your audience and kind of have some sort of pretty like strong emotional response, whether it's like fear or wonder or surprise or amazement. At the kind of powers of these objects. And there is a lot of art theory at the time that talks about this as being the power of art, that the art can move us. It can move us emotionally. It can move us physically as well. And if you really want to change people, if you want to change their hearts or their way of thinking, you have to move them. You can't just have a kind of dry, rational debate. There has to be some kind of emotional engagement to change people's hearts and to change the way that they think. So that really was considered the power of these moving statues. And that goes back all the way to Aristotle, how he writes about them, because Aristotle says that wonder, you know, moves us, and then wonder leads to curiosity, because you're like, I wonder what makes that statue move. And then curiosity leads to learning and to philosophy, to trying to figure out some of the mechanical principles and things like that. So there's that kind of idea that I think the Dutch artists are really taking from antiquity and from ancient texts that talk about the power of culture to move people, to transform them, to make them think differently. So so that's a powerful thing. And I guess art still does that. I mean, that is the kind of power of art, is it moves us. It makes us think about something slightly differently.
Maybe, and just emotes, right? So we get something out of this. The Dutch word for that, by the way, is bewegelijkheid. And I just feel like we should all take a second to think about Dutch as a language. All right. I would like to walk through the book, which is organized a bit like the Doolhaven themselves. Yeah. So let's start at the beginning. So the first thing, who are we? These visitors? Are we wealthy? Are we poor? Are we men or women? Are we residents? Are we visitors? Who's going to these?
Yeah. So that is kind of what's interesting, and I think maybe the most novel thing, because there always were these automata displays, as I said, for elite people, for kings and princes and people who had palaces. But it's this new idea of making these things accessible to the public. So there was an admission fee, but it was fairly low. So anyone who could pay admission could go to visit these sites. So they're a little bit like early museums. And so that's interesting because they are open to everyone. So, you know, women, children, perhaps, you know, urban laborers, there is a whole range of people who could go. But within that, what I saw in the publicity for these sites, because there are some posters and there are these booklets that they sold, they're really trying to target a specific audience. And that tends to be foreign visitors to Amsterdam, so international visitors, because Amsterdam at this moment has just become like a sudden rise to power, has become the kind of global hub of world trade. And so all sorts of people are coming into the city. And in a way, the city government wants to convince people that Amsterdam is not just an economic center, but it is the cultural center. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of cultural supremacy of Amsterdam. And so they're trying to kind of keep up to their new economic status by also trying to impress people with cultural prowess and wonders. So they're targeting that audience, and they're targeting really like educated upper class men. So there's a real mix in the audience then, because those people did go, like I saw that in the their travel documents and their travel accounts. But local people could also go because it's in your neighborhood. And so it's it becomes this kind of mix of like a really kind of open public audience, which is a new kind of way of looking at art, because automata and wax would have been seen mostly by elite people more than kind of public.
So we go in, we go in, we're with friends, where maybe it's our neighborhood, we grab a drink, and you know, kind of get in a mood, and then we walk in, and your chapter two starts with the triumph of Bacchus and Ariadne, which is, I don't know, what do we call this? Is it a fountain? Tell me about it. What is this?
It is I kind of started to call it a multimedia assemblage.
Yes, that works. It is a multimedia assemblage.
Yeah. So it's a fountain that has life-size sculptures. And again, it doesn't survive. So we just really have a print of it. So working from that print, there were marble statues. There's Bacchus. He's riding like in a chariot. It's pulled by leopards. And then Ariadne is there too. And she's sort of kneeling in front of him. And he's holding up a bunch of grapes. So Bacchus, the god of wine, it kind of presides over this site because it is a pub. And so it is a place where you go to drink. And then there are all these sort of amazing waterworks that squirt out of this fountain. And that too, to us might look kind of familiar, but in the time period, that sort of hydraulic technology was really new, how to sort of force water to kind of spout out into these kind of upward sort of squirting streams of water. That would have been a really kind of marvelous thing for people to see as well, because Amsterdam didn't have public fountains. There were public fountains like in Rome and in Paris, but not in Amsterdam. So they're not exactly public because they're in these courtyards, but they're quasi-public because you could pay your admission fee and go in and see this. So this would be the first kind of wonderful thing that really strikes you as putting Amsterdam on the map in terms of new artistic and technological innovations that are on display there.
So we're struck. We're in awe, right? I mean, Bacchus and Ariadne are amazing, and here's this thing. But leopards are pulling a chariot. There's a fountain. We've never seen this. We go past that, and then we go into the labyrinth. Right.
First you get drunk, right?
And then you go into a labyrinth.
Oh, but you miss the squirting out of the pavement.
So,
You're standing there looking at this statue. The sources tell us that the women who are standing there would suddenly be surprised because a squirt of cold water would come up from the pavement. There's a kind of pebble pavement around the statue, and it would squirt up your skirt. And so they'd be kind of wet by this thing, and they would scream and they would jump around. And so again, there's a way it moves you emotionally and physically, like you have this kind of trigger response to being unexpectedly sprayed with water up your skirt. And people thought this was hilarious, of course. And so you wonder, why is it only the women? Like, how is it that the fountain can distinguish? But it's a kind of mechanism that is worked from a distance. So you have to imagine somebody sitting somewhere and waiting until a woman stands exactly in the right spot, and then kind of, you know, activating this mechanism and dousing this woman. So it is quite sexist to pick out the women in that way for this particular kind of humiliating treatment. But
and that well, it wouldn't be quite so funny as well. Yeah. It wouldn't be quite so exciting with a man in pants, but it is also, it's ridiculous, and she's jumping around, and that is hilarious, but it's also amazing, right? There's water coming out of the ground in a good way.
Right? Yeah. So it's a kind of complete sort of surprise and shock. And that seems to be the dynamic of the whole site, is to catch you off guard, to surprise you, to shock you, to move you. And then I guess hopefully to impress you so much that you change your way of thinking. There's some sort of
shoved into a receptive state.
Yeah, yeah.
You're about to be kind of also thrown off balance, because mazes, the labyrinth is there. You get lost, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, what is that evoking?
If you've ever been in a labyrinth, like I can remember going to one in Holland with my kids, and we thought it was going to be really fun. So you start out and you think it's going to be really fun, and we split up. You know, my husband had one of our kids and I had the other, and soon they were both in tears. They were scared, they were lost, we couldn't find the rest of our family. You thought you'd never get out of there. So they seem fun, but they're not fun. They're actually intensely frustrating. They're designed to outsmart you, to kind of make you lose your way. You can't see much because there are high hedge walls all around you. And you know, people often seem to dig through the hedges just to get out of them.
People lose their minds a little. They're just like, yeah, you feel really trapped.
Yeah, yeah. And then the myth of the labyrinth, again, these seem to be very classical sites. So you have Bacchus, and now you have the labyrinth, which is about Theseus and the Minotaur. And so the Minotaur is like a monster, and that's what's at the heart of the labyrinth. So even getting to the middle of the labyrinth, it's not like a big prize. It's like then you get eaten by a monster. So there's something really kind of scary about labyrinths, and kind of sobering. So you're drunk and you're hopping around and you're laughing at people around the fountain, and then you go into this labyrinth, you're isolated, you're singled out, and you're kind of terrified and you're lost. You've lost your way. So there is a kind of, I think it's so, it seems like it's almost like a little ritual route that they planned through these sites. And so the labyrinth is this kind of constricting and sobering rite of passage as you kind of go deeper into the site.
And then we engage with the automata.
Right. So then you get to if you solve this labyrinth, a door kind of opens at the end, and then you go into an actual building, because automata, you know, they would rust if they were outside. So there was a special outbuilding, a sculpture gallery. And so you would go in there, and it seemed to have been rows of seating where you'd then sit down. So you're no longer moving, you're sitting down. And then there was a stage at the front. So a bit like a theater, really. And then these moving statues, there was a curtain. So the curtain was closed. And then at set times, the posters seem to show us that there are certain times when these shows would start. There was music, so there's trumpets, and then the curtains would open. And then there was a whole kind of show, I think with probably a presenter, who presented each work, and you know, and then the work would start to move. These moving mechanical statues. So again, there's like you're sobered. You come into this dark interior. There's a kind of anticipation, and then you really are hit with these wondrous moving statues. So it's all about kind of heightening the experience, the physical experience, the emotional experience of these works of art.
I'm thinking, you know, I'm thinking about the people in public squares in Europe. I think maybe happens back in North America as well, though I don't know, where they're dressed in, you know, all gold or something, and they stand perfectly still until someone drops money, and then they jump and everybody screams and runs around, and you know it's coming, you know, we know what they do, but it doesn't matter. It still makes us jump and scream. And it's very like all the, it's this moment where you really take in your surroundings. You can remember this really well. And I'm kind of thinking of that thing with these automata. Everybody knows what they do, right? But when they move, it's still astounding.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. We have those in old Montreal here. And it's the same, I guess it is similar. Like it's kind of terrifying. Like I hate those. Like if I see one, I go out of my way to avoid it. And, you know, kids hate them because they're scary.
Yeah, but also some kids are drawn to them. And so they drop their quarter and then scream and run.
So there's a kind of fear and pleasure. But I guess it's about a heightened emotional and physical response. That's very staged, but it still kind of works. Yeah.
But it's still really effective. And it feels like this. So tell me about these, what are we finding? We're inside. What's the show going to, what are we going to see?
Yeah, there are different types. There are some that were like pretty complicated, where there'd be like even a little Bible story. So there's like these small, almost like a mini stage set, and then different figures would come out. So there's King Solomon, and he's sitting on a throne, and then the Queen of Sheba comes in. So you imagine she kind of rolls in, creepy creak, and then Solomon stands up and he moves his scepter up and down to welcome her. And then she bows. And so she hinges at the waist, and then she's got a retinue of other people who come in. And so I imagine the presenter is maybe telling you the Bible story as these are kind of smaller figures. They're not life size. They're maybe half life size figures. And they're all dressed in these, you know, sumptuous costumes, which is also part of the interest of looking at them. And there was music that accompanied it. So it was kind of like a little theater performance, but acted out by these little mechanical figures. So part of the wonder is just trying to figure out how it is they're moving. I guess here in Montreal, we have a store called Ogilvy's that always has a Christmas display with little teddy bears. And they're like, they move around.
The elves are pounding.
Their eyes click back and forth. Yeah. And so it's that type of attraction, which is still, you know, fun to see.
It's fun to see. But there is, you know,
setting is there in costumes and
But there is something, because if we wanted to tell a biblical story, we could also use people.
Yeah.
But instead we're using these machines. So there's something kind of, there's still an excitement about this, about the science of it, about the engineering as well.
So it's a sort of funny combination where they seem to often pick familiar stories, like either biblical or classical. So you assume that the audience, most people would know the story already, but then the novelty is the new technology and the mechanical figures using those to act out these stories. So they're that type. And then there were life-size automata. So the David and Goliath that survive are those type so these would be human-sized figures, again, dressed usually in kind of foreign costumes or historical costumes, and some of them would play music. There was a figure who played the bagpipes, and so his fingers actually moved and his eyes moved, and he played like familiar tunes somehow on these bagpipes. And so again, it's this kind of wonder of being struck by the strangeness of it and not knowing how it works, trying to sort of figure out how it actually actually works. And I don't think that that part was explained, the mechanisms. I don't think they ever revealed like the inner workings of these machines to the audience, because you had to kind of keep people coming back.
Mm-hmm. So. Sure. I'm just trying to imagine this little experience. So these big automata, we also have a lot of wax figures. What do they do? What are we supposed to learn about our wax figures from our wax figures?
Yeah, wax figures also are very creepy. Like if you think of Madame Tussauds or something like that. And they have a long, long history as well. And so a lot of these things, fountains, automata, wax, it seems like the artists were thinking about classical antiquity and trying to revive mm-hmm. some of these ancient art forms. And so wax works, we know they appeared in like ancient Roman culture, that people had busts of their ancestors cast in wax. Sometimes you would actually take a, you know, an actual cast from someone's deceased face. So these death mask kind of mm-hmm. things, you can kind of picture those. So there was a long tradition of wax works. And again, it's something that, because wax is so brittle and friable, not many of them survive. And so there haven't been a lot of really serious studies mm-hmm. of wax works, again, because the actual, you know, 17th century wax works, none of them survive into the present. And so often for art historians, that kind of disqualifies, if you don't have the actual object to work with, then that kind of disqualifies it. So waxworks too, they kind of, what they seem to do is they keep the memory of somebody alive, but in a very kind of material way, so that the actual living presence of that person, where you can see their face even after they're gone, and often it's too, they're dressed in costumes that represent who they were. It keeps the dead alive in a strange way. Because mm-hmm. I think we would have photographs mm-hmm. of deceased people. If someone in your family, you know, you would have a photograph to remember what they look like, because that is important to us. And so waxworks played that role in ancient societies. And then it's also sort of being carried through in the 17th century, which is interesting. So, and a lot of these waxworks were of different European rulers. So like Henry IV of France, King Gustav Adolphus of Sweden, and then the Dutch stadtholders, so William of Orange and his descendants, and the British royal family as well. So it's showing us a political alliance between Protestant European rulers. And so I think that was part of the kind of political and religious aim of these sites, was to show the audience, here is Europe. We have a strong alliance between these ruling class people. Even if they die, they have heirs. And mm-hmm. And again, it's that thing of the work of the Reformation being ongoing. And so the military part of it, the war that's mm-hmm. going on, that the Dutch are engaged in with Sweden and France and England, that's part of their larger goal of reforming the entire world, turning the whole world into a, you know, converting the whole world to Protestantism. So it kind of brings those leaders, those military leaders, to life. And there, the change is probably to make people want to sign up and fight for this mm-hmm. cause.
Sure. And see the reason for it as well, because it's constant and it's expensive and it's inconvenient as well as yeah. everything else, right? Even if you're not going to go fight, someone you know is. It's the constant war is upsetting to the whole kind of social order. So getting yeah. behind yeah. the cause.
Yeah. yeah. And so how do you get people to get on board, to sign up, to risk their lives? Partly this kind of idea that if you're a hero, even if you die, you'll be remembered. And so, you, like these waxworks statues. And so trying to, I guess, provide some incentive. And again, they're drawing from ancient traditions where statues were used in that way to kind of galvanize people around a political cause.
Right. Okay. So we've come kind of to the end of this story, because we've gone through, we're leaving, and you know, we're getting to the point where eventually these are destroyed and almost nothing remains, right? Which is sad, I think. Inevitable, symbolic, I don't know. What happens to these things?
Some of them do continue for, like, they're almost in operation for 300 years. So it's quite a long time. So they really were these very beloved civic institutions. But then as Amsterdam expanded, some of them were destroyed then because Amsterdam expanded quite a lot in the 17th century and new canals were built. And some of these sites, these inns were, you know, in the wrong spot. So they were demolished in the expansion of Amsterdam. So some already disappeared in the 17th century. The Oude Doolhof was the one that lasted the longest. And then it was sort of sold in the, I think, the 1860s or so. And at that point, it was demolished. Some of the statues were taken into the Amsterdam Historical Museum collection. Well, it was an early, to the City Hall, actually, mm-hmm. and displayed there, and then went to the Amsterdam Historical Museum later. And some of them maybe were sold into private collections, so we don't know what happened to them. And so very few of them seem to have survived. I guess they also get old and decrepit and they sort of fall apart and they weren't restored. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing kind of fell into obsolescence. And people did seem that, again, there was kind of publicity at this time. People did seem quite sad to see these sites go because they were seen as this kind of aspect of old Amsterdam, of the past. And so there's a kind of nostalgia about it too, but and then they go into the museum collections and eventually end up in the cafe.
And then they just become a memory of something that we once experienced instead of a thing we're experiencing.
Yeah.
Right. So your book goes a long way to restoring the story to memory, perhaps reestablishing the wonders in our imagination, definitely reinstating them in the scholarly story. So what is it, like, if there's only one thing that we as readers of the book, listeners of our podcast, should take away about these moving statues, what's our takeaway?
Ooh, what's our takeaway?
I guess. Question, isn't it? Yeah.
It is about the power of art, I guess, that in the 17th century, and I think that's still the case today, people really do understand how art can change people, that you can reach an audience. The more you can move an audience, the more you might be able to change their way of thinking, whether that's political or religious or social. There's a kind of power, that is the kind of power of art and of art exhibitions. So art and the exhibition of art is still a really kind of powerful phenomenon. Nice. I guess that would be my takeaway.
That's a wonderful takeaway. Let's keep that. All right. Thank you so much. You've taken so much of your time. So I only have one more question left, which is what's next? What are you working on?
Oh, thanks for asking me that. I'm working on a new book that is looking at 17th century Dutch art in relationship to the transatlantic slave trade. Because, mm-hmm. There have been a lot of big exhibitions recently at the Rijksmuseum mm-hmm. and the Rembrandt House, Maurits House, where we need to take into account anti-Black racism and how that actually has shaped the history of Dutch art, the way that we study Dutch art, the way that we understand it, the way that we exhibit it. And that's a story that strangely has not, you would think there's a lot mm-hmm. of awareness around this, but there strangely is not a lot of art historical scholarship that really integrates that, to really kind of think about how art and atrocity and these horrific mm-hmm. kind of brutal colonial practices are really closely connected. Like the Dutch Golden Age, which I think we no longer call it that because there is a kind of growing awareness that the prosperity that came from overseas trade was mostly achieved through horrific violence, exploitation, enslavement, not just of people in Africa. There was a lot of enslavement in Asia as well, by the Dutch. And so there's a whole kind of hidden history or secret history of the 17th century that scholars are just really, you know, I mean, there's always been some scholarship on this, but to really make that central to the story that we tell about the 17th century, about Dutch art, which, you know, is so much a part of almost any major museum collection, has a pretty prominent collection of Dutch art. So how do we display that and tell the public this story about what the Golden Age, what was really going on globally with the Dutch in the 17th century. So
where did that
a challenging project, but an interesting one.
Yeah, it sounds fun. It sounds really interesting. Probably not always fun, but
No. It's you really have to think about the nature of evil and how people could treat other people and dispose of their lives in such a callous way for their own self-advancement is pretty much what you get from this. So, so
I mean, that's kind of the story of humankind on some level, right? Like we've got a good history of earning our wealth at the expense of others.
That's right. So you can kind of see the relevance to today. You know, if you look at where our consumer goods are coming from.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this is not a completed story by any means. Interesting. Well, that's absolutely necessary work. And I'm really excited to see the outcome of that. So
great. Yeah, sure. We'll talk again.
We'll talk again next time. All right. Once again, thanks for taking time with me. And I wish you good luck in the coming pursuits.
Great. Thank you.